I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. This week, while all eyes have been focused on the impeachment hearings in the House, two monumental cases are being argued at the Supreme Court. In one, justices heard arguments on whether or not the Trump administration used a proper legal justification for ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, known as DACA. Protesters, led by DACA recipients, gathered outside of the Supreme Court as the hearings were underway.
DACA has opened so many opportunities and allowed me the ability to pursue my ambitions.
Today we say to the Supreme Court that we are living and breathing human beings and our lives are on the line.
If there was a pathway, people would stand in line. We want nothing else but to stand in line and be able to have our papers.
I am proud to be an immigrant. I am proud to be a dreamer.
Here to stay.
Another case before the court is Comcast Corporation v. National Association of African American-owned Media, and it's received far less media coverage, even though it's been called the most important civil rights case on the docket. More on that case in a few minutes, but first we start with DACA. And here with me to discuss is Caitlin Dickerson, immigration reporter with the New York Times. Caitlin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So walk us through some of the arguments that the Supreme Court is weighing when deciding whether or not the president can essentially end DACA.
The court is looking at whether the president has the authority to end DACA. And really at issue is, you know, who can make immigration laws and immigration policies? Is it the president? Is it Congress? Is it both? This is something that's been debated for a long time. And I think we've seen historically that no administration has wanted to create immigration policy by memo, but we've seen everybody do it. So we saw the President Obama do it in 2012 when he created DACA in a Rose Garden ceremony. He acknowledged the weaknesses in that policy, but he said Congress won't act. So I have to create, you know, in his view, this policy. And the Trump administration was saying, no, that policy was illegal and it should have been left to Congress.
We're hearing a lot about how the Supreme Court might lean, but there were questions that we heard from the Supreme Court justices yesterday. Does that give you any sense of where this might be headed?
You know, trying to anticipate where the order is going to come down is a dangerous game. You know, I've learned in my career not to spend too much time trying to guess. But I think that what we did hear is that the justices sort of agreed, including the conservative justices and the Trump-appointed conservative justices, that nobody wants DACA recipients to be deported. But the question is, can they be given these special protections by the president when, under the law, they're eligible for deportation just like anybody else? And that's under the law that Congress set. So I think they made very clear there was no interest in deporting DACA recipients, but whether they should get the protection of this policy, which not only allows them to live in the U.S., but gives them access to work permits. Your work can give you access to health care. You can get access to a driver's license, all these privileges that under the law they don't get. I think that was where the conservative justices had more questions. And they certainly seemed to feel that the Trump administration was within its authority to eliminate DACA.
And also, let's talk about who DACA recipients are, because I think this has sort of been in and out of the news over the past couple of years. Some of the information coming from the White House, some would say, is misleading. What is the criteria for applying for DACA? Who's eligible to stay as a DACA recipient right now?
Sure. So the bar is really high. That's why you only have about 790,000 people who have DACA. I think contrary to what President Trump tweeted on Tuesday ahead of the oral arguments, he said some DACA recipients are hardened criminals. But actually, one of the primary eligibility requirements is that you can't have a serious criminal record. That means no felony conviction of any kind, no serious misdemeanor conviction, or more than three misdemeanor convictions of any kind, you know, something like driving without a license, even that can be held against you. In addition to that, you have to either be working toward or have a high school education. If you're not a veteran, you have to pay a fee to get involved, and you also have to, you know, maintain that clean criminal record over time. So, you know, as somebody who spends almost all my waking hours interviewing immigrants, when I talk to DACA recipients, it's almost, you know, it's amazing, really, the group of people who are involved. They're just incredibly accomplished. You know, more than 90% of them have jobs, and so it's been impressive to hear those stories over time.
You mentioned that justices that you've spoken to, including conservative justices, are reluctant to want to deport DACA recipients en masse. Is that because of the optics? Do you think that that's because of the political implications that could have ultimately?
I was referring to what justices were saying in court, that they did not think that DACA recipients should be or would be deported by this administration. And as you've already pointed out, you know, we want to be careful in trying to anticipate what President Trump is going to do, because on immigration, he's kept us guessing from day one. I think that there are two factors at play in terms of not wanting to deport DACA recipients. One might be the political optics, but two is that I think everybody agrees, you know, we have at least 11 million undocumented people living in the United States. Immigration authorities have very limited actual capacity, money, and manpower to carry out those deportations. And the idea of going after a group that has, as we said, you know, high school educations, veterans, very highly employed, you know, no criminal record, it doesn't make a whole lot of logical sense. And that would be, I think, an example of, you know, with the folks who are challenging DACA are saying is that the Trump administration acted arbitrarily and capriciously, which in layman's terms is kind of in a mean way in eliminating DACA. And similarly, going after DACA recipients for deportation, I think, would be seen in that very same light.
It's an important case, and we will be sure to stay on it. Caitlin Dickerson is an immigration reporter with The New York Times. Caitlin, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And we're going to focus in on another major case that was in front of the Supreme Court this week, Comcast Corporation v. National Association of African American-Owned Media. On the line with me now is Hassan Kanu, legal reporter at Bloomberg Law. Hassan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks for having me back on.
So lots to talk about here. Byron Allen is a cable giant and media mogul. He's brought a racial discrimination case against Comcast. Remind us of the details of this case, Hassan.
Right. At bottom, the allegations of Mr. Allen's case are essentially that Comcast didn't enter into certain contracts with him, didn't take on certain channels, TV channels that he was pitching to them because of race discrimination. That's the bottom line allegation. What the Supreme Court will be looking at, though, is a sort of more technical but very, very impactful question. The statute that Mr. Allen is suing under applies to lots of sort of disputes, legal disputes in the economic sphere, right? Mr. Allen is suing because of supposed alleged race discrimination in between business contracts. This is also a statute. It's the oldest civil rights statute in the country, a Reconstruction era law. And it's often used to remedy things like redlining, housing discrimination, someone being denied a housing opportunity, even though they're qualified because of their race, someone being denied a loan, and in simple sort of employment discrimination, lots of other spheres. The question the Supreme Court will be deciding is what standard applies. Essentially, does a plaintiff, what does Mr. Allen have to allege in his complaint? Does he either have to allege that race was a motivating factor in an adverse decision against him, in this case, the decision not to take on his channels? Or does he have to allege that race was the, what's known as the legal term would be the but-for cause? And that essentially means that Comcast might have or would have made a different decision, but for, except for the fact that Mr. Allen is a person of color or a black person here. That's the sort of technical question that the court will be looking at here. But the underlying case that you're referring to is Mr. Allen essentially alleging basic race discrimination on Comcast's part for refusing to accept these channels that he was pitching.
And one of the things that, to your point, that this has been called, at least by civil rights advocates, one of the most important civil rights cases on the docket. Is that because, depending on how the court rules here, that ruling could then be interpreted and applied to other civil rights cases, which frankly are difficult to prove because they often rely on the burden of intent?
Exactly. The court's decision on the standard here would be precedential, meaning it wouldn't just apply to Mr. Allen's case going forward when it goes back to the Ninth Circuit, more than likely. It would apply to every other race discrimination claim brought under this statute in the future. And what you're referencing there is the fact that in either standard, and the Chief Justice, in fact, made this point yesterday, that even under the tougher but for standard, where you have to prove that a different decision would have been reached if maybe you were a white person, for example, that it's still difficult to prove that, because as you're saying, a lot of times race discrimination operates as a sort of mental construct. And so you're essentially having to get into the mind of another person. And it's very rare that you have sort of direct evidence of racism. It's highly, highly unlikely that you're going to find an email between an executive right after a meeting with Mr. Allen, or that an executive looked Mr. Allen in the face and said something to him that was a direct communication of the fact that I'm making this decision based on the fact that you're a black person.
to that point, I mean, we know that these cases are very difficult to prove. I was going to ask you what Byron Allen has, if anything, in terms of evidence of racial discrimination in this case. And what I mean by that is just when you look at the landscape of who owns the media in the United States, media consolidation is one big issue. Lots of companies are now under big media companies, and many of those are owned and or run and operated by white Americans or very non-diverse corporate boards. So is that part of Byron Allen's argument of evidence of racial discrimination, or is there more?
They have certainly made that sort of more broader policy-based argument about sort of how the lack of diversity in media ownership. But more so than that, their argument is focused on the fact, and this is sort of stemming from how courts thus far have analyzed these sorts of cases. Their argument is centered a lot on the fact that their business is qualified. They've showed that they have their sort of, you know, they have all their I's dotted, all their T's crossed, all their ducks lined up, that they pitched what would have been a profitable TV channel, not very different from other channels that are currently on TV or other pitches made by other businesses. And so that it's sort of hard to discern why Comcast would have made a different decision. And that's why the standard here is important, because Mr. Allen's case is really about whether he advances to trial, at which point he would have the ability to sort of subpoena, get documents from Comcast, et cetera, and sort of build up more evidence other than just sort of making the comparison that, hey, look, my business was pitching a good deal. We've had successes in other areas. Comcast has accepted other channels and other deals like mine, but they didn't accept mine. He would then be able to get sort of additional evidence of that in advance if he's able to pass the test that the Supreme Court essentially picks.
Hassan, what's the role of what's the Department of Justice play in this so far in this case?
Well, the Department of Justice has weighed in here on Comcast's side, pushing for the more difficult test to surmount that would make it harder on plaintiffs to prove race discrimination. It's sort of undercovered. Most news coverage has been focused on Comcast's position. But that's obviously important in light here of the fact that the DOJ is obviously a part of the Trump administration. I think Secretary Clinton just pointed out just a day or two ago three different headlines about race discrimination in America, the fact that we've held a record number of migrant children in custody, as Ms. Dickerson was referring to, and referring to other uptick in hate crimes as well, making the point sort of that these things are connected. So it certainly matters that it's this administration and this DOJ. We know the president and the White House has pretty tight grip over even independent agencies. It's certainly important that it's this DOJ that's making these arguments that would sort of make it harder for plaintiffs and complainants of race discrimination to prove or win their case.
Hassan Kanu is a legal reporter at Bloomberg Law. Hassan, thanks so much.
Thank you.